Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Disturbing reports of targeted attacks against civilians have continued to emerge from the northern Mozambique town of Palma, marking a serious escalation of violence and volatility in the Cabo Delgado region. Issuing the alert on Tuesday, UN agencies reported that dozens of people had been killed during attacks by unnamed insurgents who reportedly descended on the town at the weekend. Families have fled sporadic ongoing violence, seeking refuge in the surrounding bush. Some of the 670,000 people who've been displaced by the insurgency that began in October 2017. More than half are children, explained Marixi Mercado, spokesperson for UN Children's Fund, UNICEF.
We are expecting more children, and again, as I said, there were already 350,000 children displaced in Cabo Delgado. That's an extraordinary large number of children who are displaced right now, and they are in desperate need of help, all of them.
In addition to continuing insecurity in Mozambique's north, the aid response has been hampered by a severe lack of funding, with the $254 million appeal only 1% funded. The daily struggle for millions of Syrians after a decade of war is getting worse, not better, UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres said on Tuesday in an appeal for more than $10 billion to help them. In his message to the online donor meeting hosted by the UN and the European Union, Mr. Guterres explained that more than 13 million people inside Syria need assistance to survive this year. That's over 20% more than last year, and the majority of the population is now facing hunger, the Secretary-General said, before highlighting that another 10.5 million people outside Syria also require support. Every month, humanitarians bring help to 7.6 million people in Syria, including across conflict lines and cross-border operations. Most of these aid workers are Syrians who've suffered because of the conflict, Mr. Guterres said, adding that they've braved immense odds and thousands of them have shown extraordinary commitment and endurance on the front lines. Also addressing the pledging conference in Brussels, UN Syria envoy Geert Pedersen urged participants to push for a countrywide ceasefire. Although the front lines of the conflict have remained stable for around a year, hospitals and civilians are still getting hit, and five foreign armies operate in proximity from one another, Mr. Pedersen said. World leaders have joined the World Health Organization's call for an international treaty to improve pandemic preparedness after COVID-19 for the sake of future generations. So far, 25 heads of state and governments from all regions have given their support to the initiative, which is being spearheaded by the UN Health Agency's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. In a joint article published across leading news platforms, the signatories said that the coronavirus crisis had been a stark and painful reminder that nobody is safe until everyone is safe, and that there will be other pandemics and other health emergencies. The main goal of the treaty, which all 194 members of the World Health Organization will decide upon in May during the World Health Assembly, is to foster a new approach to strengthen national and international responses to future pandemics. Tedros noted that a future treaty could promote timely information sharing on outbreaks, equitable access to vaccines, and vaccine technology. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The warming currents of the North Atlantic are the weakest in at least 1,600 years. As that ocean breakdown continues with climate change, seas will rise higher in New England. More vicious winter storms contract towards Britain and Northern Europe. Dr. Lefke Caesar is the lead author of the new paper, Warning the World. Meanwhile, official international agreements to save us still rely on fantasy technology. From the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, scientist Fabian Stenzel says the dream of plantations burning wood for energy would take away life-giving water from billions more humans, not to mention the impact on the natural life of this planet. Kevin Anderson from the Tyndall Center tore away the curtain from that Beck's Tech on Radio EcoShock 5 years ago. Now we have proof. There is no real workable plan to stop extreme climate change, just a global lie at the top. Now you know, and as G.I. Joe always says, knowing is half the battle.
Radio EcoShock.
Ocean currents that keep the East Coast and Northern Europe warm are weakening. Proof keeps piling up. Is there a tipping point? and how long until we get there? From Maynooth, Ireland, Dr. Lefka Caesar returns with the latest results. In 2018, Lefka published her first paper in the journal Nature. She appeared on Radio EcoShock to explain it. Lefka Caesar is part of the Irish Climate Analysis and Research Unit at Maynooth University. She's also a guest scientist at PIC, the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. The latest word doesn't sound too good. Published in February 2021 in Nature, the paper is called Current Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation Weakest in the Last Millennium. Lefka, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
You just returned from a shipboard expedition. What are you up to?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I just spent the last 2 weeks basically in the Northeast Atlantic, and we took ocean measurements there, which basically allow us to track different water masses. And the long-term goal is to find a connection between the large-scale circulations in the Atlantic, like the AMOC, the Gulf Stream System, and the, well, currents closer to the coast of Ireland and other countries, because they are really important for example, well, the coastal conditions and therefore for fishing industry and sea level rise at the coast. And we try to make that connection by, first of all, collecting data.
You were trained in German universities, but now work out of Ireland as well. What is at stake for Ireland if this great Atlantic circulation system continues to weaken or even eventually stop?
Oh, well, Ireland is, I guess, for European countries, one of the countries that is just most affected by the Gulf Stream system. I mean, well, I live in Maynooth, which is close to Dublin, but if you go to the southwest part of Ireland, to Cork, for example, you have like palm trees growing there, which is something I'm not used to from Germany. And if the system changes by a lot, this will definitely have impact on Ireland climate conditions. What they are exactly is definitely ongoing investigation, but it might result in a less mild climate than the one we are experiencing right now.
Palm trees in Ireland. I had no idea. So we should introduce any latecomers to one key term, and that's AMOC. We're going to say it again and again. What does it stand for, and what is it?
Well, AMOC is short for Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. So Atlantic is pretty clear because it's a system of ocean currents in the Atlantic. And meridional is basically the fancy term for south-northward. So kind of just, this is like the meridional direction. And that name comes because the overturning circulation is flowing from the south of the Atlantic towards the north. And we call it an overturning circulation because on the way towards the North Atlantic, it consists of warm and saline surface waters. And on the way back, it's actually flowing in deeper ocean layers and consists of colder and less saline water. So we really have like an overturning of water masses.
Well, people in North America think of the Gulf Stream, but others in the UK talk about the North Atlantic Drift. Talk to us about this great engine as a kind of system rather than a single current with many moving parts.
Exactly. So it would be wrong to say that the AMOC is just the Gulf Stream, but the Gulf Stream is part of the overturning circulation. As I said, the overturning circulation consists of many, many different currents. It's also wrong to actually say that these currents are exclusively part of the AMOC, but that's a question about a definition. So the Gulf Stream itself, for example, is largely actually wind-driven, and it can carry way more water masses than those that actually contribute to the overturning of the AMOC. But I guess for a common person, it would be important to know that when I talk about the AMOC or when scientists talk about the AMOC, they don't just refer to the Gulf Stream, but actually what we call the Gulf Stream system, consisting of, as I said, many, many currents.
Well, I get some of my scientists from the reputable source Wikipedia, and of course, that's not to be relied on, but they do say that measurements of the North Atlantic current are usually taken at 26 degrees north, the latitude of sub-Saharan Africa or Mexico. That sounds strange to me. Why not much closer to Iceland or Ireland, or did they get it wrong?
Oh, well, if they put down that that's measurement of the North Atlantic current, then that would be fairly wrong. So the AMOC, that is measured at 26 degrees north, and that's basically a question, as I said, of definition and also, of course, comparison. So at 26 degrees north, you actually span the whole width of the Atlantic, so several thousand kilometers, and have a network of different measuring devices, mainly that's like buoys, but also moorings. And they then can track all the water masses, not just the surface flow of the overturning circulation, which would be the Gulf Stream at that latitude, but also the deep return flow. And that then enables us to get an idea of how strong the overturning circulation is, even though it would be correct that it does depend on where exactly you measure it. You get a slightly different strength. That's not actually that problematic if we want to look at the long-term trend, because for that it's just important that we always take the same latitude to measure the strength.
And your study attempts to reconstruct the North Atlantic current system all the way back to the year 400 of our common era. We have difficulty measuring what is happening now. How could anyone possibly know what ocean currents were doing hundreds of years ago?
That's a really good question, and you're right. So these measurements of the overturning circulation started only in 2004. So for everything before that date, we actually have to look at what scientists call proxy data, in the sense that they give you not a direct but an indirect way of measuring the ocean current. And to find the right proxy data for the overturning circulation, you have to know, what does the overturning circulation do? What parts of the climate system are affected by it? So what we, for example, look at is actually the sea surface temperatures in the South Polar North Atlantic, because the overturning circulation is carrying a lot of heat towards that region. And as the overturning circulation slows down, there's less heat being transported into that region, and we see a cooling. Now, we didn't just look at this one proxy data, because as you can imagine, the sea surface temperatures in the South Polar North Atlantic are also affected by the atmosphere. And that's basically the problem of any kind of proxy data. It is also affected by other parts of the climate system besides the one that you really want to pinpoint it to, in our case, the overturning circulation. So something else we looked at, for example, is actually the grain size in ocean sediments, because if you choose the location right, then these grain size can give you an idea of the speed, of the velocity of the ocean current, of the deep ocean current at that place, basically just because of the reason that a faster ocean current can actually carry larger grain sizes with it than a slower one. And this is what we did. We looked at all these different proxy data, also, for example, looking at the abundances of different coral species. And they are all related to the AMOC, to the overturning circulation in a different way. And we thought if they nevertheless all show the same message, the same evolution of the overturning circulation, that means that we really increase the trustworthiness of these results, basically, our confidence that they are right.
In the new paper, you present a brief history of the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. When was it last deemed stable, and when did the Great Weakening pick up speed?
Yes, so as you already mentioned, our data go back as far as 400 AD, and we see that since that time, at least, the AMOC appears to be really stable. So it does have a little bit of decadal variability, but that's normal for a part of the climate system. And only in the midst of the 19th century, it starts to really show a decline in all of the different proxy data. And instead of basically going back to increasing in strength, there's actually a second decline that we see starting in the midst of the 20th century, which is even more rapid than the first one. And this both then leads to the overturning circulation over the last decades being at a lower state in strength than ever before in these 1,600 years.
Can we chart out the rate of weakening all the way to the year 2100, and with what confidence?
Well, it's difficult to say that there's like a certain specific rate of weakening, in the sense that despite this long-term weakening, there still and always will be some kind of natural variability of the overturning circulation that is basically overlaid, superimposed on this long-term trend. So it would be possible, for example, that the overturning circulation actually will gain some strength over the next few years. but it will very, very likely then weaken again, because this is what we see in all the different climate models that we're looking at. And it seems to be that, and this, of course, depends a lot on our behavior, on how much carbon dioxide is emitted to the atmosphere, but we should expect at least another 30% of weakening until the end of the century, maybe even up to as high as 50%.
I was rummaging around looking at another paper led by Francisco Muschietello, and it's published in Nature Communications in March 2019. They determined that abrupt climate changes appeared in Greenland ice cores about 400 years after changes in the North Atlantic deep water formation. Could there be a 100 or 400 year delay before impacts of deep water changes are seen? What do you know about the ocean as kind of a forerunner of changes on land?
Oh, there definitely could be some like very long-term in the sense of centennial implication that we do not see right now. This is basically because the ocean does react slower than the atmosphere to changes, just because of its size and being capacity of storing heat, of storing carbon. And if the overturning circulation is starting to slow down right now, it might take a long time before it like completely shuts down. And because of its role as a carrier of heat, for example, from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere, we do see, and there are like even more studies on that at the moment, that changes in the overturning circulation can have long-term implications for both hemispheres, just because they're just changing how much heat is transported towards a region or not. So I guess I wouldn't pinpoint the timescale to being exactly 400 years, but there are definitely long-term implications of a slowdown of the overturning. And one of them is, of course, whether or not the overturning circulation will tip, in the sense that, well, we call it a tipping of the overturning circulation when the further slowdown can't be stopped anymore, even though we actually might be able to deal with climate change in the sense that we stop global warming. So right now we're at the point, very likely, that if we stop global warming right now, then the overturning circulation will recover. But once it tipped afterwards, we could stop global warming and it would not recover, but it would actually continue to slow down even further.
Well, you've made several important points there. I mean, whether it's reversible or not is something I was going to ask you about, but also that this is not just a story for New England or Ireland or the UK and Northern Europe. This is something that could affect the whole of the global climate system.
Oh, definitely. Because right now, I don't know whether this is general knowledge, but basically the northern hemisphere is warmer at the moment than the southern hemisphere on average. Of course, it depends. There are seasonal differences, but on average, there's more heat on the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere. And this is part because of the overturning circulation. And of course, the whole marine ecosystem in the Atlantic is used to the overturning circulation flowing as it does, to its distribution of nutrients, of carbon. And there are so many other things. We know that the overturning circulation plays a large role in actually the storage of carbon in the ocean. So right now the ocean is actually taking up a lot of the carbon that we're emitting to the atmosphere at the moment. And therefore, it's like a buffer, and it leads to the global temperature not increasing as fast as it otherwise would be or could. And the overturning circulation plays a large role here. So there are, and this, I think, in my opinion, is one of the really great dangers, there are probably a lot of implications of a slowdown of the overturning circulation that we do not know at the moment, or that we do not know about in detail at the moment, and which makes it a high risk to play with, in my opinion.
How much of the AMOC weakening can be attributed to fresh water pouring off Greenland, including the strange cold blob of water south of Greenland?
Oh, that's a good question, and we can't pinpoint here exact numbers. So it seems that at the moment, actually, the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, even though it is increasing, is not the major driver in the slowdown of the overturning circulation. But that is actually at the moment rather that we have a warming of the deep water formation sites. And with deep water formation sites, I mean the place where the overturning takes place, where the water masses are sinking to deeper ocean layers. And because warm water is less dense than cold water, actually also the warming of that areas would affect the overturning circulation. But what we see from model simulation is that the Greenland ice sheet melting will very likely play a more important part in the future, and that at least in climate model simulations, the melting is capable of stopping the overturning circulation.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from Maynooth, Ireland is Dr. Lefka Caesar, talking about the slowdown in North Atlantic currents that heat Europe and North America. When you get right down to it, Lefka, we all want to know, how does a warming planet manage to change an ocean system so vast? How do increasing greenhouse gases change the motion of the ocean?
Oh, that's basically the link you already mentioned. So basically, increased greenhouse gas concentration means a warmer world. I guess that far is known to most people by now. And when we have a warmer world, well, we don't just have a warmer world. We also see changes in a lot of other climate factors, for example, in the precipitation patterns. And for the North Atlantic, it's the case that in a warmer world, we have actually more precipitation over the North Atlantic. This is one factor that adds fresh water to the North Atlantic. And then, as you said, we have the melting of the Greenland ice sheet. We also have the melting of the Arctic sea ice. And of course, sea ice is not completely fresh water, but sea ice is actually fresher than the ocean water below it because of the freezing process, basically. So there are different factors in a warming world that lead to fresh water being added to the subpolar North Atlantic. And as fresh water having a smaller salt content is also less dense than the saltier ocean water, this again is hindering this formation of deep water, which is one of the main drivers of the overturning circulation. But I know sometimes it feels like, well, such a small thing basically can have such a large impact. But that's basically the story of Earth's climate, that sometimes small local factors can actually have a large impact.
Well, suppose we don't reach a tipping point anytime soon, but the system continues to gradually weaken over time, as we're already seeing, and you've documented in this paper. What are the impacts of that?
Well, we don't know all of them yet, I suppose, but what is very well understood is basically that a slowdown of the overturning circulation can actually increase sea level rise at the U.S. East Coast, basically for cities like New York or Boston, which is basically linked to some basic physics of the Earth. So due to the Earth's rotation, when you're on the northern hemisphere and you're moving northward, you would be deflected to the right. So a human doesn't feel that force, but you can actually see it, for example, on train tracks, that the right side is more used, basically, because there's a force trying to deflect every moving parcel. And this also happens to the overturning circulation. So basically, because of the flow of the overturning circulation, water masses in front of the U.S. East Coast are deflected to the right. And when the overturning circulation slows down, this force is weakening and more water can pile up at the actual coastline, basically increasing sea level rise there. This is like one pretty well understood mechanism. What we also see from climate model simulations that a slower AMOC is linked to increased storm tracks over the North Atlantic. So it could, in principle, increase winter storms for example, the UK or other parts of Northwestern Europe. And this might seem like very paradox, but especially for the 2015 heat wave in Europe, there has been shown that this is actually or has been linked to the cold temperatures, the cold sea surface temperatures in the subpolar North Atlantic at that same year. This sounds weird having cold water temperatures and a heat wave, but what those cold water temperatures did is that they favored a position of the jet stream, that is the strong atmospheric circulation, that allowed warm air to be channeled into Europe from the south. And so there are like many indicators of what could happen, and we just have to investigate further into that.
Well, some of us have seen the movie The Day After Tomorrow, and that was the doomsday fear where the whole overturning system might reach a tipping point and it shuts down. Is that possible?
Well, it's possible that it shuts down, definitely. It's not possible in the way the movie showed it. So what we have to understand that abrupt climate change happens on timescales that in the human mind not appear that abrupt. So the overturning circulation is not going to shut down within a couple of days, and not even within a couple of years, even when the tipping point is reached. So what's the importance of the tipping point being reached is that it's afterwards unstoppable, but it will still take a long time for it to actually happen. And then I guess in principle, some of the things shown in the movie are correct, but they are all like crushed into really, really small timescales, I guess, to make it more interesting, because making a Hollywood blockbuster basically taking over the timescale of decades might be more difficult because, I don't know, aging actors and so on. So, no, the message is it can stop, but it's not going to look like as in the day after tomorrow.
There was a slight slowdown in the weakening in the 1990s, and I'm wondering, can we create another pause or a reduction in the rate of weakening by slashing greenhouse gas emissions, or would the process continue anyway once it started?
Well, as I said, when the AMOC really tipped, it will be basically very, very difficult to halt it, and unlikely that we can do it. Right now, at the moment, we can definitely still interfere in this process, but it won't be a linear response. So just because we have like 1 year of less global warming doesn't mean that this 1 year shows a weaker AMOC slowdown. But that is because there's so many processes and elements that are affecting the overturning circulation that we can only like see our changes in behavior on the longer timescales. But no, it's definitely, actually it's really important that we know that when we reduce global warming, we will also reduce weakening of the overturning circulation.
Well, obviously, we need to know a lot more. Are measurements of the North Atlantic currents, the temperatures, the salinity, the motion, are they being taken in real time now?
Yeah. I mean, not everywhere, but there are different basically networks of measurement devices and at different places of the North Atlantic. So there's also now one in the South Atlantic looking what's happening there and whether this relates to what's happening in the North Atlantic. And then not just in the North Atlantic at 26 degrees north, but also higher up where we can monitor the actual process of the overturning of the deep water formation better. I guess here it's always, of course, a problem of basically funding, of getting enough money to support these measurement networks in the future because they're pretty expensive. But right now there is data, and I hope there will be more data in the future, because for some of these places, we only have data for like 1 or 2 years, and that's not enough to understand the whole process.
Is there any central agency or institution that's charged with monitoring the health of the North Atlantic currents, as important as they are to civilization as we know it?
Well, there's not like a single institution, but there are actually different international projects where different institutes, mainly, of course, from countries like U.S., Canada, and then those one in Europe, which are close to the North Atlantic. And they do an effort of, yeah, basically keeping these monitoring systems. But there's like not one AMOC watch organization.
Perhaps we should have one. Meanwhile, where in the IPCC reporting process are the ocean changes in your report? Will this possible regional cooling be included in the AR6 synthesis report coming out in January 2022?
Yeah, I've basically been in contact with a few of the authors for the corresponding chapter of the report, and so I'm pretty confident that it will be in there.
I guess my concern is fundamental changes could happen in ocean circulation without immediate consequences, perhaps, and then appear in a dangerous, rude surprise. Or is the whole process too slow and it's buffered by the sheer size of the ocean? Do we know for sure what to expect?
Well, we don't know for sure what to expect, but I mean, humans, we do live, or hopefully live, like, I don't know, 70, 80, maybe even 90 years. So I guess it's true for the whole climate change process. We start, even as humans, we start to see changes in the sense that we compare, I don't know, winter, summer times, and this, of course, is mainly weather. But if we compare it as we experienced it in the last years to how we experienced it 20, 25 years ago, then I guess even humans can definitely grasp some changes. Might be more true actually for people who work a lot of outside and have the direct connection. But the problem is there's like no early warning system that tells us from basically from climate, from nature, oh, if you keep doing this, this will happen. But we actually might know about something only at the point where we can't stop it anymore and we can't really do anything anymore. And that's one of the great dangers of climate change.
It sounds a little bit like science fiction almost to think that we could have a little ice age practically in the UK and Northern Europe if this whole overturning circulation shifts. And that could happen while the rest of the world is warming a great deal and because the rest of the world is warming a great deal. Don't you find that strange?
Well, I guess maybe not that much anymore. I guess if you, like me, are confronted with the strangeness of the climate system basically every day, you just kind of start to get used to it and it doesn't feel as strange anymore. But I suppose it, in the sense, it does feel weird and maybe unfair. But it's also important to know here, due to, well, basically going on global warming, even if we have a little cooling here, it will, over the course of years, be overlaid and at some point basically overruled by the general warming trend. So it's not going to be like really cold suddenly here, just because, as I said, the slowdown of the overturning circulation, it's showing its effect takes some time. And at the same time, we just have increased global temperatures anyway.
And are you going to keep your focus on this subject, or are you already branching out into other research? What are you up to now?
Oh, no, I definitely keep this focus. And I just want to understand more, because we do see, as I kind of mentioned, we see this natural variability of the AMOC. But that, too, is not completely understood, because while we are used to climate or elements of the climate system showing natural variability, there has to be a cause behind it, and we would like to understand that. And then, of course, it's also interesting to maybe actually have or find some way of an early warning system of a further slowdown. And so I'm looking a little bit into that. And then I'm really interested in digging more into the consequences for right now, mainly Europe, mainly Ireland, of the continued slowdown. So that's definitely still my focus area of research.
We have been speaking with scientist Levka Caesar. She is working with the Irish Climate Analysis and Research Unit at Maynooth University and with the Potsdam Institute as a guest scientist. Her latest paper published in Nature is titled Current Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation Weakest in the Last Millennium. You can find links to learn more in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Levka, thank you for coming back to report new science on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The International Panel on Climate Change serves over 190 national governments. It has a plan to keep global warming below at least 2 degrees C warming this century. But instead of changing our fossil-based civilization or our whole population, the plan relies on a fantasy about industrial-scale planting, burning, and storage of carbon. It's called BECCS. And without that, this planet is rushing towards a climate shift so extreme, some scientists call it extinction level. In 2016, I interviewed the outspoken deputy director of one of the world's top climate research agencies, the Tyndall Centre in the UK. Start with Dr. Kevin Anderson's brief introduction to the problem on Radio EcoShock, followed by my new interview with lead author of key research on proposed carbon slashing tech, Fabian Stenzel in Potsdam, Germany. This is a couple of minutes from Radio EcoShock, November 16, 2016.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to the program, but I have to tell you, sometimes my research for Radio EcoShock gives me a sickening feeling, like I'm falling into a bad hole. We all are when it comes to the developing climate shift. This time, it's a new article published in October by Kevin Anderson. In the UK, he's a professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester and deputy director of the renowned Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research. His co-author is Glenn Peters, a senior researcher for CICERO, the Center for International Climate and Environmental Research in Oslo, Norway. The title of the paper is deceptively simple, The Trouble with Negative Emissions. It's big trouble. We've had Dr. Anderson on Radio EcoShock before. He's very popular. I've run a speech or two by him. He's a truth teller who is somehow tolerated by the highest levels of established science in the UK and now in Sweden. Anderson has recently become the second person to hold the Zennström Visiting Professorship in Climate Change Leadership at Uppsala University. As I read further into the new article by Anderson and Peters, what began as a sense of unease quickly developed into full-blown horror. Every few paragraphs I had to walk away to recover a little before continuing. It's not that we're being lied to on a massive scale. We are. But that's not the point. We're lying to ourselves on a massive scale. The agreement reached by our political leaders in Paris and now in Marrakesh reflects our own unwillingness to make deep changes now to save the climate. As we see in this paper, it also marks our very human way of answering a real threat with procrastination and fantasy.
But the one that is most commonly used in the models, in fact, most commonly, it's almost the only one that's used at scale within the models that advise governments on climate change, is something called BECCS, Biomass Energy Carbon Capture and Storage. And here you grow biomass around the planet. You then harvest that, and as it grows, it absorbs carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through photosynthesis. You then harvest that plant material. You convert it into some useful fuel form, like pelletize it or something like that. You transport it around the world in ships. You put it into trains. You take it to the power stations. You burn it in the power stations. And as you burn it, you then capture the carbon dioxide that is released into the chimneys. You liquefy the carbon dioxide, and then you pump it down pipes and, again, store it underground for a few thousand years. So that's the other technique, and that's the one that dominates the models that are used to advise governments, this BECCS, Biomass Energy Carbon Capture and Storage. And none of these technologies are up at any scale. Most of them are just sort of laboratory level at best. There are one or two preliminary pilot experiments with BECCS, but nothing of any size on any power stations. And indeed, carbon capture storage itself using fossil fuels is still undergoing quite a lot of experimental work, and there was only really one reasonable size plant available globally looking at that, but just standard carbon capture and storage from a power station. So there's a lot of work to be done of all of the technical elements of these, even though in theory at least, in a textbook, each of these things works in isolation. But at scale and collectively, there are no examples of these technologies.
I'm not a fan of building another industrial infrastructure in order to handle the problems of industrial infrastructure. That was Kevin Anderson in 2016, Deputy Director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research at the University of East Anglia, UK. Now let's get to the proof with our new guest from Germany.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Let's just green the planet to capture carbon dioxide that threatens the future. Official institutions are counting on biocapture and storage, but like so many big human ideas, could this climate solution really make things worse? Our guest is a PhD student in Germany. He works with the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. His new analysis is published in the journal Nature on March 8, 2021. Fabian Stenzel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
Fabian, what is biomass plantation? And do they exist already?
Yeah, so a biomass plantation is a managed plantation of fast-growing grass or tree species. And the aim there is to capture as much CO2 from the atmosphere as possible. And yes, they do exist already, but set aside for firewood purposes and as a craft material, almost exclusively for tests and for research purposes.
We had Swiss scientist Thomas Crowther on Radio EcoShock a couple of years ago. He calls for planting billions more trees. Is that enough, or does this attempt to control the temperature with natural global cooling, does it need plantations?
Well, first of all, I think trees are our friends, and they can really help us, and we need to make sure that we preserve and restore all possible forests that we can to reduce the impact of climate change. But the issue here is that trees grow relatively slowly, and they have the most carbon uptake per hectare in the first years of their of their existence. So to maximize this carbon uptake rate, you could cut them down every 3 years. And then you're basically at a biomass plantation. So yeah, I wouldn't really call it natural because yeah, these plantations, they wouldn't be biodiversity rich and they need a lot of management. But in most of the IPCC scenarios, there's a strong need for them.
What sort of plants capture the most carbon, the fastest, and why would irrigation be required?
This probably depends on the climate and where you are on the planet. So there are two types of biomass plantations. The first one is the woody type. So in general, they have to be grown where the climate is more extreme. So, for example, in the temperate regions or in the boreal zone, you would have willow or poplar plantations. At least that's how we parameterize them in our model. In the dry tropics, you could use eucalyptus. If you have enough water available, also possible with irrigation, then you can use herbaceous, so grass-like plantations. And about the irrigation, as I said, it's about management. And as a farmer of such a plantation, you want to maximize the productivity of this plantation to make the most effort. So you would fertilize them, and if there's enough water available and you need the water to make them more productive, you would also need this additional irrigation. And this also has a synergy with the carbon price. So if there would be a carbon price in the future, that would also be applicable reversely, so to say, to a negative emission. So you pay for putting CO2 in the atmosphere, and then you get money if you extract it, then this would enhance all this again.
The title of your new paper in Nature is Irrigation of Biomass Plantations May Globally Increase Water Stress More Than Climate Change. Is this your PhD dissertation in one of the most prestigious scientific journals?
Actually, this is the third and last paper of my PhD. So we started off with a literature review on how much water is there and potentially is needed in the future for biomass plantations. Then as a second paper, we did our own modeling study where we looked at how much water is needed for a reaching 1.5 degree scenario. And now this last paper looks at the resulting water stress from the water demand. And yeah, I was fortunate enough to have a great supervision and colleagues, team and co-authors so that we made it into Nature Communications.
I guess we better describe what you mean by water stress. What is it?
There's demand for water in a certain region, and this demand comes from a lot of different users. So there's industry demanding water, there's agriculture, households, and if the demand grows and grows, then at some point it becomes hard to fulfill the demand by the natural availability of water. In our analysis, we model this by the demand to supply ratio, and if this ratio is higher than 40%, in the yearly mean, we call this high water stress. And this means that of all the available water during the year, 40% or more is requested, and this is already quite a high number. And I fortunately never had to endure such a situation, but there are many people worldwide which have had this situation and many more who will have to face this situation in the future.
I did look online and I found a world water scarcity clock. It counts the number of people facing water stress. When I checked, it was heading over 2,400,000,000. That is almost one in three people on the planet always looking for enough water to bathe, to clean up, or even to drink safely. What do these increasing numbers depend on? What forces are already driving water stress even before we consider plantations to capture carbon?
The demand is increasing, and it's increasing because there's population growth, and with the population growth there comes demand for water for food production, for industry, for livestock production. And this went on for quite a few decades now, and it potentially will also go on in the future. And then additionally, we have bad water management, so losses or contamination of water due to bad infrastructure. And on top, and yeah, this is the stuff that we are most concerned with here at TIC, is the climate change impact. So there will also be an impact due to the increasing temperatures.
Yes, and then we hear the technical term that can make some people wince. What is BECCS, B-E-C-C-S, and why should we care about it?
BECCS stands for bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. It's a combination of the biomass plantations I already talked about and combining it with an approach, an industry, a technology to capture the carbon that is in the biomass and store it somewhere. And this is usually done by putting the biomass in a power plant, basically like what you would do with coal or gas, and you burn it. But from the exhaust, you capture the CO2. And then you store it, you pump it into an underground reservoir, an old oil or gas field or such, and then technically it's out of the sight of the carbon cycle.
It sounds like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assumes that biocapture and storage will be an important part of our future. What is their position?
Well, the IPCC reports, they strongly depend on all the research that is happening in the research community. And a lot of the socioeconomic scenarios from the integrated assessment models that make these projections, they depend on sex. So many of the 2-degree scenarios and almost exclusively all of the 1.5-degree compliance scenarios, they need a lot of sex. And then on the other hand, the IPCC also highlights that there are potential side effects. But as of the AR5, well, the latest, and the 1.5-degree report from the IPCC, there was not that much research in this field. And this is where our group and also other groups come in and have a look at these potential side effects to quantify a little bit what that would mean if we need these large plantations.
Okay, when we try to project these numbers forward, what scale of planting and growing would be needed to take meaningful amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere?
So in our 2019 paper in Environmental Research Letters, we find that in order to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees, we would need more than 1 gigahectare, so more than 1,000 megahectares of bioenergy plantations. And we would also need a substantial amount of fresh water to irrigate them to meet the negative emission demands for 1.5 degrees. And this is crazy. So if we are not carefully governing these plantations, we will, as I said, need an additional 2/3 of the current area that is in agricultural use, and we would double our current freshwater demand.
So we're talking about terrestrial carbon dioxide removal, and I get that growing plants consume carbon to build their stems and leaves and everything, but where does the storage part come in? How does that work?
If we just leave the biomass to itself, then it will decompose and the carbon will be released, and we are back at where we started. So we need a means to store it away and remove it from the carbon cycle. We could also use it. So another option is to, if you have a classical forest, not one of these short rotation plantations, then you could also build something with the wood. But this doesn't work with these short rotation plantations or with the herbaceous biomass plantations. So we need to store it away. And this is where the BECCS, the CCS in BECCS comes into play.
Is there any commercial scale facility in the world that has actually captured and stored carbon from burning plants?
Yeah, so there is an institute, the Global CCS Institute, and they reported last year that there are a few carbon capture and storage facilities, but just very few. And even fewer of them have an input of biomass. So most of them are actually classical coal power plants. And then they put a CCS on top to make it, well, carbon neutral, so to say. Or some of them are also coupled to enhanced oil recovery. So they will actually use the CCS part to extract more oil or gas from the underground.
What brought you and your team to question the impacts of this comparatively or allegedly natural negative emissions technology using plants?
Yeah, so our group at TIC, the group of my supervisor, I have to say, she's on my group, we're working with a global vegetation model. We are known for studies on sustainability, on food security and planetary boundaries. And then we were included in a large research consortia funded by the German Research Foundation, who wanted to look at climate engineering or negative emission technologies. Our part was to look at the potentials, but also the side effects this could have. My part was the back part. And I had also a lot of colleagues, 6 years, that this was in research. My colleagues Tim Behringer, Vera Heck, and also Lena Boysen, I think, who was already on the show. We looked at the potentials and the associated land and the water and the fertilizer requirements and what this would mean to planetary boundaries. And then you said this natural technology, and I have to stress again that I don't think that BECCS plantations are natural. So there will be a lot of biodiversity loss if you would use this approach. They might be green, but I wouldn't call them green.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest and scientist Fabian Stenzel from the Potsdam Institute. So we try to imagine this proposed future. It sounds like every available space would be planted with fast-growing, carbon-sucking plants. And aside from displacing real nature, which is not just, a minor thing, How could this mass planet level grow up alter the cycles and the movement of water itself?
We would need a massive additional amount of withdrawal, and this, of course, would affect downstream water availability and also downstream water use. And it would require a large additional infrastructure for this irrigation. You need the pipes, and you need the equipment on the field. And then as a third thing, it would potentially also have downwind effects. So if you do these large plantations and the large irrigation water, you will strongly increase the evapotranspiration in that area. And this has the potential to modify the precipitation patterns. And this can be beneficial, but this can also be detrimental. We don't know unless we have looked at the specific patterns. Yeah, this is something very important.
Yes, I just spoke with the scientist, the director of the UK Tyndall Centre, Robert Nichols, who was talking about how cities and larger areas are sinking because of groundwater removal. So that's another factor, but we won't go there today. Your study tries to measure changes in water which are already altered by climate change itself, plus humans are moving around and clearing and burning and logging landscapes. How do you calculate a projection with so many moving pieces?
Yeah, this is a very crucial point. And fortunately, we didn't have to model this all on ourselves, because we only have a biosphere model available, which cannot deal with all the socioeconomic parts. So there is a great project, which is called the ESIMIP project, and they provide a large set of scenarios for the future. And we inherit their socioeconomic assumptions, and we can also use their climate inputs and the land use patterns. And then we add our assumptions on how much irrigation is needed, and then we analyze the water stress. A large part of what we do is actually we pick those scenarios that are interesting, and then we look at what those would mean for water stress in the future.
I was looking at figure 5 in your new paper, and we see a huge difference in the amount of planted land required for RCP6. That's a warming of 3 or 4 degrees C by 2100, pretty disastrous, versus the low emissions future hoped for in RCP 2.6, maybe 2 degrees of warming by 2100. To stay below 2 degrees C by the end of the century, what countries or regions stand to lose the most nature or croplands for bioenergy plantations as we're talking about?
Yeah, well, that's a very crucial question. And I'm a little hesitant to now call out this and that country is going to have a lot of problems in the future. These are all scenarios, and they have a lot of assumptions in them, and they are reproducible, but a lot of these assumptions might also change in the future. So in those scenarios that we use, there will be required a huge additional amount of area and also water in all continents, but the specific future patterns, they strongly depend on the governance and also how economic incentives are placed. So this might change in the future of specs. I think one part of our research is actually to steer in the right direction so that these patterns that are projected maybe now won't come true and we will find a better pattern that is more sustainable, so to say.
Fabian, this is news nobody really wants to hear. We have a big problem with developing climate threats. It doesn't look like machines can grab enough carbon. We love plants. Why are you raising this difficulty now, and how confident is your team in the results of this study?
First of all, I want to stress again that these plantations are not a forest. They are not a natural ecosystem. They are, well, as natural as a cornfield, so to say. Our results have potential to be a big bummer for the BECCS implementation, but it's a very important thing that we understand the potential side effects of BECCS, and that we try to look for alternatives or maybe also portfolios of different technologies that have synergies with each other. Well, the most important part is always we have to focus on emission reductions first before we think about these technologies that might help us prolong a little bit. Well, we are quite confident in our model and in the results, and I think now it's up to the community to maybe create better scenarios and better future projections.
Saying biocapture and storage as a climate carbon cure could be worse than the disease is very serious. How did you come to that conclusion?
Yeah, we only talked about water stress so far, but of course, climate change has a lot of other effects. So sea level rise, melting glaciers, heat stress, and we only took this one dimension of water stress. And with it, we want to highlight that the side effects of BECCS deserve more attention because our Earth system is much more complex than the current scenarios look at. And that's what we want to highlight.
Well, if, as you say, the global area and population living under severe water stress in the BECCS scenario would double compared to today, It sounds like this climate solution is incompatible with the lives of billions of humans, and that doesn't sound very green. Is there a middle ground? Are there tipping points to watch for, or what about solutions for the water problems?
There's a lot of hope, I would say, that there is a potential for a portfolio of different negative emission technologies, for example, biochar or natural climate solutions, which were also raised by Thomas Crowley. We would have to stop degradation of wetlands and that find out with which management we can maximize the carbon sequestration on croplands. And then there's also the large potential for a better or more sustainable water management. This is also something that we looked at in our study. We actually find that with sustainable water management, we can draw down these effects of water stress in the future for quite a bit.
Could this green climate tech be regulated to appear only in places that have enough rainfall or river flow and that it doesn't conflict with human needs? I suppose it would take another study to figure out how much we can sustainably plant and how much carbon we can capture without damaging nature. What are your thoughts?
Yes, this is definitely very important and one of the options we have. And this is also something that we plan to model in the future, but it would require a much more complex model setup. So we cannot do this right away with our model, and we're working on it. Integrated assessment models, which create most of these scenarios for the IPCC, they are also refining their approaches, and I'm sure they also take into account and will put more emphasis on the actual physical basis and the side effects. To conclude, I think it gets clearer and clearer that there are no silver bullets, and BECCS is not at all a silver bullet, and we need a strong global coalition against climate change, and we really need to start now and not rely on these technologies that are not even ready yet.
Aside from this study, Fabian, what do you do at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research?
As I said, I'm currently finishing up my PhD thesis, and then I will soon start a postdoc. And we will look more general into ecosphere degradation, so global risks to humanity, and for example, look at the links between climate change and biodiversity loss as a result of land use change. Yeah, that's something that also other people would say. Climate change and biodiversity loss, they are maybe some of the greatest challenges that we have right now and that we have to face.
I think that's so important because so much of what we hear about climate change is, well, humans will do this and it will have this impact on humans. And we're not alone on this planet. We have these billions of other species and we count on them as much as they cohabit with us. From Germany, we have been speaking with Fabian Stenzel. He just led and published the study, Irrigation of Biomass Plantations May Globally Increase Water Stress More Than Climate Change. Find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Fabian, thank you for sharing your time with us.
I thank you for the interest.
I'm Alex Smith. We wrap up with more from my 2016 interview with Kevin Anderson, then of the Tyndall Center. He explains the madness of counting on fantasy to bail us out of a horrible climate shift. So how likely is it, in your opinion, that we'll find a technology even larger than these mass natural systems like plants and ocean life and ocean currents?
Well, firstly, can you find it? I mean, I think can we find them at that scale? I think we can find technologies that will do this. So this is why I say I find we should carry on researching them and so forth. The question then is, can you, and this is often the problem between science and technology and then actually engineering it in reality, can you build them fast enough? Can you build them at all? Does the infrastructure cause you lots of problems when you're trying to put that in place? And then you've got other questions. You know, does it technically work? Is it very inefficient? Can you absorb as much as this as is assumed in the integrated assessment models, which are different to just the climate models? These are the main integrated assessment models, are the models where the climate comes together, the economists and people looking at the technologies, and these are the ones that they use to advise governments. They're assuming very high levels of negative emission technologies, and when you look at the technologies and you look at what's assumed in the models, you think, can you actually build them that fast? And some of the provisional work that Glenn and I are doing suggests that as early as 2025, you'd have to be rolling these out at several very large plants every few days. So, I mean, it just looks completely unrealistic just to be able to deliver them, let alone at the moment there's a high level of uncertainty about whether these technologies would actually work at all. So I don't think we should just sort of park them and forget that they're there. I think we should be researching them, but we should mitigate as if they will not work. The assumptions in the models are absolutely huge in terms of the level that they uptake of these technologies. They're going to be built very rapidly, starting within 10 years from today. and keep rolling them out right on beyond the end of the century. So think about that. We are saying because we are not prepared to mitigate today, we're going to carry on removing CO2 from the atmosphere right through beyond the end of the century. By the middle of the century, many of the models assume that the technology that we would have developed on our planet will be absorbing as much as all of the oceans do today. That's about 10 billion tons. By the end of the century, quite a few of the models have us at 20 billion tons. In other words, it's like having another biosphere that has been towed in next to our planet that will absorb the CO2 that we put in the atmosphere. All of this is because we're not prepared to make the really deep, rapid changes that we could make today in order to hold us to 2 degrees centigrade. So I think there is a real risk of these technologies, not only not working, but actually that they are undermining our mitigation agenda today. What we are not in favor of is to assume that they work in the models that we are using to advise governments. And many of the policymakers have absolutely no idea these technologies are in there. When they are aware they're in there, they have no idea of the scale of which they're there. I recently attended a conference in Oxford, the 1.5 degree C conference, looking at these sorts of technologies. And some of the people were talking about, from the modeling point of view, were talking about how much was assumed to be captured. And you could almost see people spitting out their coffee. Some of the other earth scientists that were there, they themselves were not aware of the absolute scale that was assumed to be in the models. I mean, I know some of the ones that were there. I taught them during the breaks and so forth, sort of shaking their heads in despair that this could possibly be considered. And these are people working in the area. So I think what's happened is that these models have used this approach, and that many of the sort of Earth system climate scientists haven't been even aware that they were used at this sort of scale, even if they were sort of broadly aware that there was some discussion around them. So I think it's very unlikely that the policymakers have any grasp at all of what is underpinning the advice that they're receiving from this particular group of modelers, the integrated assessment modelers.
Because the IPCC reports and the Paris agreements and the talks going on now, they're all based on this assumption that we're going to have this wonderful technology at very high levels, and you found that that may not be realistic, and it's stalling action.
That is a real risk. You captured it very well there. I think that is our concern. It stalls action today, which would be fine if we knew they would work. And if they do work and they've stalled action today, then yeah, okay, we've stalled action and we get a bit more emissions than we would have otherwise got. If we stall action today and they don't work, and there's a very serious risk that they will not work at scale, then what we have done is passed on an appalling legacy to future generations and to the poor and climatically vulnerable people around the planet. We'll have handed them the worst of everything we could possibly imagine, all the things we have tried to say that we should try to avoid at Paris. Would have effectively put back on the table the business as usual sort of scenario, 3-4 degrees C warming, if not more, by the end of the century.
From Radio EcoShock 2016, that was Dr. Kevin Anderson. Find links to that interview and to our guests for this show, Levka Caesar and Fabian Stenzel, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. As always, you can listen for free or download it to your iPod, MP3 player or computer and listen later. Or pass the link on to everyone you know. Join us again next week as we continue our trek toward ecological sanity. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.